Call for Action presents Of Consuming Interest, a public service show that discusses scams, deceptive offers, and other consumer concerns. Here's the director of WUSA 9 Call for Action and your host, Shirley Rooker.
You think your house is yours? Well, it is until the government decides it isn't. Eminent domain is the power of government to take private property. We're going to discuss this issue today and what it means to you. My guest is Ilya Solman. He is a professor of law at George Mason University, and he's the author of The Grasping Hand, which is about the Kelo case, which was a landmark case about 10 years ago that has significant impact on us and will probably continue to have significant impact. Ilya, welcome to Of Consuming Interest.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, let's just talk briefly about tell me what eminent domain is.
Sure. Eminent domain is the power of the government to condemn private property and use it for various projects. If they believe, for instance, that they need your land for a road or a bridge or all kinds of other purposes that might be specified in the law, they can come and condemn it. And if they do, that means that you have to give it to them for a set price determined by the courts, even if you would prefer not to sell at all or only willing to sell for a price higher than the one that they're offering you.
All right. Talking about price, is that generally would be the true market value of the property or no?
Yes. The Supreme Court precedent says that they have to give you fair market value,
which
is roughly the value that would be determined if you sold the property in the open market. However, studies show many people don't even actually get that much.
Oh, really? That doesn't seem quite fair. Well, let's talk about the fairness of this whole issue. Eminent domain, the concept says the government, if it has a supposedly legitimate purpose, can take your property and use it for, as you just got through saying, public use or whatever they deem for the public good. You don't have any rights except, I guess, you can fight it. It may or may not be a winning battle in court. But there was a landmark case about 10 years ago that had to do with property in Connecticut called the Kelo case. Can you describe that for us, Ilya?
Sure. Kelo was a case where the city of New London, Connecticut, decided to condemn 15 properties, residential properties, for the purpose of transferring them to a private developer so as to promote economic development. And the Fifth Amendment actually says that you can only condemn private property if it's for a public use. So the owners of these homes, they said, this isn't really a public use, it's just being given to another private entity. And the case was fought all the way up to the Supreme Court, where in a close 5-4 decision, the court said basically that a public use is anything that might provide some potential public benefit, in this case development, and the government doesn't even have to prove that the supposed public benefit will actually result, as in fact in this case it didn't result, because to this day, 10 years after a Supreme Court decision, which happened 10 years ago this month, the property is still almost completely undeveloped. Nothing has been built, and the main users of the land are a colony of feral cats that have taken up residence there.
Oh my God, that's disgraceful. Now, going back, so the decision was to take this property, 15 different owners lost their property. It's sitting there. So the county, the state, the city, everybody's losing out on this, including the people who live there. What happened to the developer who was the cause of all this and decided not to follow through? Anything?
So it's a little bit complicated because the condemnations were actually done by an organization called the New London Development Corporation, which was a nonprofit organization that was given the authority to this by the city. And they were going to find other developers to work with, but they never actually did successfully carry that plan out. The NLDC did take a lot of criticism for their role in this issue, but the organization does still exist, albeit a few years ago they changed their name.
Are they still a nonprofit?
Yes.
Hmm. Okay. That's another story. All right. Okay. So this case then, it decided that they could take this and give it to a private developer to use, although the person acting as a representative was a nonprofit organization. Was that nonprofit organization set up specifically for these purposes?
Technically, no, because it does other things. However, it is very likely that it was, in effect, reestablished after a period of dormancy, in part to carry out this very project. In 1997, when it was, in effect, reestablished, it was because the state government wanted to do this project, but at the time, the state government was controlled, or at least the governorship was controlled by the Republicans, and they didn't especially want to work with the Democratic-dominated New London city government, and they decided they would rather work by resuscitating this nonprofit entity. And so this entity became a kind of go-between between the Republican governor and the local Democratic-dominated city government, though both the state and the city government eventually did support this condemnation project, which turned out to be very badly conceived, and indeed many people at the time pointed out that it had serious problems.
Really put the screws to the consumers who owned those homes. I mean, really. Okay. So the property's sitting there now. Who owns it? Is it owned by the city?
It is technically still owned by the New London Development Corporation, which now has another name. The city has been working with the organization, and there is now a plan to use one of the condemned properties as a memorial for victims of eminent domain. So if that memorial park is built, that will use one of the properties and will be development of a sort, but obviously it's hardly the kind of dramatic economic benefits the city that was originally promised.
Well, quite to the contrary, this whole thing, because I'm assuming this nonprofit was not paying taxes on the ownership of this property, or were they?
I would have to check that, but in general, nonprofits do not pay taxes
their
land. Though obviously the taxes that you would pay on land that has nothing on it would in any event be less than taxes on land where there is a valuable structure there.
Right, but nevertheless, they're probably getting a pass on any tax. I run a nonprofit, Call for Action, and I know about the tax laws. And so, okay, that's very convenient. We'll refrain from commenting on that. And so your book is focusing on, I love the name of it, The Grasping Hand. Ilya, tell me where people can find your book.
Sure. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, various other such websites. It's also available at the University of Chicago Press website because the University of Chicago Press is the publisher.
And if someone wants to get in touch with you, do you want to give out information or is your a website that they could visit?
Sure. You can Google me and find my website. Also, I blog regularly at the Volokh Conspiracy Blog affiliated with the Washington Post website.
Mm-hmm.
Volokh is spelled V-O-L-O-K-H.
Volokh website, blog at the Washington Post.
Yeah, we're hosted at the Washington Post website.
Okay, so that's how people can find you. And his name is spelled, by the way, I-L-Y-A-S-O-M-I-N. Okay, let's just take a brief pause here to let our listeners know that they're tuned into Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Ilya Selman. We're talking about his new book, The Grasping Hand. I love that title, Ilya. I just see this hand coming here and grabbing my property and taking away from me. Very visual title. All right, so we're talking about the whole issue of eminent domain, the government's ability to seize it if they say they have a good purpose. What do you see as the far-reaching impact of Kelo? This means that the government did it provide any kind of protections for consumers, or does this mean going forward from that case that it's easier for the government to condemn your property?
So the Kelo decision had an impact in two ways. One, you've already pointed to, it reaffirmed longstanding, but in my view, badly misguided precedent, which already said that the government can condemn your property for almost any reason that it wants, so long as there's some possible benefits to public that might happen, which exists almost in every case. So in that sense, it was a very dangerous decision. On the other hand, ironically, it actually made things better for property owners because it caused a huge controversy. Before Kelo, almost all experts simply just assumed that everybody agrees that the government should be able to condemn property for virtually any reason it wants. This case was a close 5-4 decision, so the issue is now debatable. Moreover, the case caused an enormous public reaction. Polls show that over 80% of the public disagreed with the decision, and in the aftermath of it, 45 states passed reform laws to try to rein in these sorts of takings. As I discuss in my book, many of these reform laws are actually unlikely to be effective, but some are pretty strong. And overall, ironically, in the wake of Kelo, the situation is somewhat better in many places, a lot better than it was before Kelo. So although I think Kelo was a very bad decision, the pre-existing decision before Kelo was actually even worse because this sort of thing was going on, but most of the public just wasn't focused on it.
Well, I do think we're reading more and more about private land use and what your rights are in the media these days. There is a lot more sensitivity to it. I think there is a lot more publicity about eminent domain and trying to rein in, or at least consumers' desire to rein in, the government's ability to take things. Now, one thing, and it's a little bit different discussion, but this whole issue of the Clean Water Act that the EPA is putting into effect, and I don't need to discuss the act specifically, but isn't that, in fact, almost a condemnation of your property because it restricts the way you can use your property? I mean, the whole thing, like, I know someone in Florida who owns land that has water, I think they call it, what is it, the water, I don't know, it has wetlands, that's what it's called, wetlands. And all of the use on this property is restricted in those areas. So this, in effect, is a form of eminent domain, isn't it?
So as a technical legal matter, it isn't, because the law draws a distinction between situations where the government simply takes over your land and uses eminent domain to do so by initiating a condemnation proceeding, and a situation where the government says you are still the owner of the land, but you're just restricted in the way that you can use it. However, the Supreme Court has a very complicated series of precedents where they distinguish between those regulations, which in their view are not really similar to eminent domain and therefore don't qualify as takings for which the Constitution requires compensation, versus ones where the restrictions on your use of the land are so severe that it does, at least in the court's view, seem like a taking, and therefore they do have to pay you the same kind of compensation as they would if they were using the eminent domain process.
So you're saying then if the use of my land is restricted, the government's going to have to reimburse me for it?
It depends on how much it is restricted.
To
oversimplify somewhat, if it's restricted so much that you lose all economically valuable use of the land, then yes, courts will say that this is a taking and the government must compensate you. If, on the other hand, the restrictions are less onerous than that, then it varies from case to case. But sadly, in most cases, the courts will say that isn't the taking. That's just a regulation of land use, and you're out of luck unless you can go to the political process and lobby the government to change its regulation.
Well, the concept of private property has been with us for a long time, and do you have some history of how we came about to have private property?
So private property dates back even to before the origins of human civilization and the rise of government. Even primitive people in stateless societies had private property. It seems to be a fairly deeply rooted human instinct. Some evidence suggests that even animals have an instinct for private property, or at least some do. Obviously, the institution has changed a lot in the thousands of years since its origins, but it does go back a long time.
Well, we see animals in the jungle marking out their property, I guess.
Yeah, in a certain sense,
their territory.
So, many animal species are very territorial.
Oh, yes. Take the lions, for example. Okay. All right. So the concept is not a new concept of being able to own land, but what we're seeing changing. I guess you're saying to me that before Kelo, it was more wide open for government than it is now, but it's still pretty wide open.
Yes. So for 200 years, there's been a debate over what counts as a public use. Mm-hmm. And there's always been these two sides. One side says, as the Supreme Court said in Kelo, that a public use is pretty much anything the government says that it is. The other says that a public use must be actual use by the public, either some sort of public facility like a road or a bridge, or if it's private, then it must be something like a public utility where they have a legal obligation to serve the entire public. And to make a long story short, which I tell in much greater detail in the book, throughout much of American history in the 18th, 19th, and even the early 20th centuries, the dominant view of public use was the relatively narrower one. But beginning in the early 20th century and culminating in a Supreme Court decision in the 1950s called Berman versus Parker, the courts gradually moved towards this view that a public use is just pretty much anything that the government thinks might be beneficial. And that was the leading precedent for several decades before the Kelo case. So the original and historical meaning of public use, at least the one that was traditionally dominant, had been displaced by this much broader one, which gave the government enormous discretion to condemn property for almost any reason they wanted.
Okay. All right. Let's just, again, identify ourselves and let our listeners know they're tuned into Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Ilya Soman. He is the professor of law at George Mason University, and he's the author of the new book, The Grasping Hand, which focuses on the Kelo case in Connecticut a century ago. Yeah, right. 10 years ago, which has made a significant difference in the way we view eminent domain. Doesn't necessarily protect you. Let me just ask you something. Now, suppose I'm sitting here and the government notifies me that they're going to take my property or they're going to restrict usage severely. What do I have to hire a lawyer to protect myself if is that what's going to have to happen if I want to fight it?
So you don't have to hire a lawyer. You can represent yourself. But unless you yourself are an expert in property law, representing yourself is probably ill-advised.
Okay. And suppose I go through and I prevail. I'm still going to be out the lawyer's fees. Is that right?
Yes, generally speaking. In the Kelo case, the property owners were represented by a public interest organization that represented him pro bono for free. Mm-hmm. But most of us are not so fortunate.
Right. So you do make the point, or some of the literature that I was reading makes the point that the people who are not politically powerful, who are poor, are much more likely to be victimized by eminent domain, meaning it's just easier to take stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, on average, there's obviously variation, but on average, people who are wealthier also tend to be better connected and have more political influence. And in addition, if they have to fight in court, they're more likely to be legally sophisticated, more likely to be able to get good representation. So studies, for example, show that wealthier people, if their land does get condemned, on average, they tend to get more compensation relative to the underlying value of the property than people who are poorer.
Well, you know, I would think in terms of, let's say, you own a farm, and there's been discovered that there's a bird on that farm, and you can't, or something, and an endangered species, and you can't use your part of your farm. And this is going to impact your income because you depend on the crops you raise for your livelihood. Where does the government come down in having to reimburse me for this? I mean, it seems...
It turns out to be complicated because, as I said before the last little break, when it's a regulation where the government just restricts your use of the land as opposed to taking it over completely, then whether it counts as a taking is a matter of applying some fairly complicated Supreme Court precedents. Mm-hmm. But to oversimplify this complicated story, what usually happens is that if the regulation is so severe that you lose virtually all economically valuable use of the land, like you can't build anything on the land at all, you can't mm-hmm. use it for anything, then courts will usually say that this is a taking and the government has to pay you fair market value compensation.
But do
if,
I still
on the other
get,
hand,
do
the
I
regulation
still...
is less restrictive than that, even if it's still fairly onerous, but you have, say, 20% of the value of the land still left over, the courts will often say, well, that's not a taking, and
oh,
therefore
boy.
You don't get any compensation.
So your livelihood is cut by 80%, but it's not a taking. Now, if it's deemed that the government has to pay you money, does that mean they actually take the land, or do you get to keep the land, but you reimburse for the fact that it no longer has this great value? Because you couldn't sell it. If you have a farm that's become this restricted, to try to sell it, I mean, no one's going to buy it. It's what was its real market value initially.
Yeah, so if you do get what lawyers call a regulatory taking, that is a situation where the government doesn't formally take over the land, but they've restricted you so much the courts say that there is a taking, then you can both get compensation, and at least in principle, you're still the owner of the property. But of course, the value of your ownership rights may be very small, because if neither you nor any future owner can actually do much on the land, then its value on the market will be very little.
It's a very complicated issue, and I can understand how governments sometimes need property for roads and whatnot. I'm not sure, but what I don't draw the line at a shopping center. There's something seems to me like there's something wrong here. But at any rate, the book is called The Grasping Hand, and Ilya, tell us how people can find it.
Sure. The easiest way these days is on sites like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can also get it at the University of Chicago Press website. That press is the publisher.
So I can get it on my tablet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There is a Kindle edition, and I believe also a Barnes & Noble Nuke edition. So you can certainly get the book on various e-readers.
And I believe what you've done is reduce this case down and make it, well, not reduce it, but make it understandable to consumers and its impact on us as we have private property and moving forward, the impact of the case.
I've tried to do so. I've tried to make the book accessible to people who are not lawyers or legal scholars, as well as those who are.
Yes. I mean, we appreciate that. Those of us who do not have a law degree, we very definitely appreciate it. And again, the book is The Grasping Hand. And I think this whole concept of eminent domain is something that consumers need to be more aware of, Ilya. And I think what you've done bringing this to public attention is of great value, because if people don't understand it, they're not going to know to whether or not they want government to have this much power.
Yeah. So one of the good effects of the Kelo case was it did lead more public attention to be shined in this issue. And I think a lot of people were probably shocked to see how broad this power actually is in many states.
Wow.
Before Kelo, experts were aware of this, but I think most of the general public was not.
What states are most protective of property rights?
So since Kelo, a number of states have enacted very strong reforms. Florida is one of them. Arizona is another. There's a number of others. At the opposite extreme, you have a state like New York, where almost anything goes in terms of condemnation.
Wow. So, folks, think about that when you're making decisions about buying property. Interesting that two very hot retirement areas, I don't mean hot in temperature, I mean in terms of where people want to go, Arizona and Florida, are ones that have really done a lot to protect their consumers' property rights. Do you think that makes a difference when people are buying property?
It makes a difference for some people, certainly. And there's some research which suggests that it affects home values, though it's complicated how strong those research results are. I do think, as we've noted before, that some types of people are much more likely to be victimized by this than others.
Right.
But even if your own land is never taken by eminent domain, you can still be a victim of this because, of course, you still pay taxes
for
these projects, which often don't produce the development that they were supposed to.
Like the one in Connecticut sitting there without the property. Okay, Ilya, thank you so much. My guest has been Ilya Soman, who is a professor of law at George Mason University. He's the author of the new book, The Grasping Hand, which is about the abilities of the government to take your private property. I'm Shirley Rooker. You're listening to Of Consuming Interest right here on 1500 AM. If you want to contact me, it's shirley@callforaction.org. Thank you for joining us.
Of Consuming Interest is a public service program presented by WUSA 9 Call for Action, hosted by Shirley Rooker. Call for Action is an international nonprofit network of hotlines which offer free and confidential assistance. If you have a complaint, contact Call for Action at 301-652-HELP. That's 301-652-HELP.